If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Ellie Cawthorn, staff writer on BBC History Magazine. Before we begin, I want to tell you about a special offer we are running for podcast listeners, where you can enjoy a 1 month free trial to all the premium content on historyextra.com, as well as a free edition of BBC History Magazine for Apple and Android devices. Head to subscribe.historyextra.com/podcast to find out more.
And also, they were excessively in love. And that is also true. I mean, he had never been with a woman before. He was 35. She'd, of course, never been with a man before. And the whole thing excited them, opened their eyes, and they changed them utterly for a while. They didn't know what to do with it except to embrace it, which they did furiously. And then they couldn't handle how to organise it.
That was Melvyn Bragg talking about the 12th century love affair between Abelard and Eloise. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available across the globe in print and digital formats. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store. Today's interview is with Melvyn Bragg, the renowned author and broadcaster, who's a long-running presenter of In Our Time on BBC Radio 4. He's just released a new historical novel, which focuses on the tragic love affair in 12th century France between Peter Abelard and Eloise. Our deputy digital editor, Eleanor Evans, met up with Melvyn in his offices to discuss the novel and the history that informs it.
So yes, obviously it's their relationship that's most well known, but I wonder if we could talk about them as individuals first, because Eloise was known as one of the greatest women in France of her time.
Well, we don't know a great deal about Eloise's deep background. We know that she was brought up in this convent of Argenteuil, which is quite near Paris, that she was moneyed. She had money. She didn't go there like the local girls who were whipped in to be nons, whipped in is a cruel word, who were brought in to be nuns, vocational nun. She never wanted to be a nun. She said she had not got a vocation. So she was immured in that place. She didn't go away on holidays to family because as far as she knew, she didn't have any family except her uncle, in inverted commas, in Paris, Uncle Fulbert. Now, modern research, and the man who's guided me most is a man called Professor Clancy, the emeritus professor of medieval history. And he thinks that Fulbert was, in fact, her father. There's such attention he paid to her. But he, in a sense, if anybody went and visited her, it was he did that. So she was brought up there, and she developed a taste for and an enormous skill in Latin, in reading the pagan authors, or the classics, as she would call them, Ovid, and particularly Cicero, and even more especially Seneca, and so on. And quite soon on, She was in communication with people in many parts of France, of learned people, about subjects to do with Latin, and they were admiring her Latin style. So she became known quite early on in her life as the cleverest woman in France. Now, there has been a great dispute about her age. Some people said she was 17, and the idea of the old scholar and the young student became, taking advantage of the young student became something to get excited about. The odds are she was in her mid-20s, maybe even older. This is Clancy again, who's done serious research on this. And so I put her at about 24 or 25. We don't know the exact date of her birth. So she's younger than him, but he was 35, and that's not much younger. And anyway, we're talking about a time when girls were betrothed at 8 in aristocratic circles and so on, and married at 13 and 14. And so there we are. But it's her cleverness that marked her out. And she did come to Paris. Her uncle brought her to Paris. And then a lot of fiction takes over. She did come to Paris. She did meet Abelard. She did keep studying. But then I direct fiction of how she got in, how she reacted to Abelard. Although the letters say a lot about that, the fiction takes over. But the background is a very clever woman, and people took her up with the greatest eminence. Distinguished scholars, heads of abbeys and all that, wrote to her, extraordinarily clever person who was also a woman. And that was and she became, I try not to make it, I don't want to be shouting women's lib about it, but the fact is she was determined to get the same sort of education as younger men than her had got at the great schools in Paris, particularly the school of Abelard. She was interested in philosophy and classics. And Abelard was extremely famous by the time she got to Paris. He was 35, as he says in his magnificent autobiographical fragment. He was the greatest philosopher in the world, as he says about himself. He's got no problem about saying that. A lot of people thought he was as well. He'd introduced Aristotle into his discussions and his writings on the scriptures, and saying the scriptures must be subject to analysis in this way. They must not be just handed down. Reason must be applied to them. And if you apply reason to them, they become better and purer. And he was taking on an immense church establishment that was getting more and more centralized and more tormented about its authority, and therefore stricter and stricter. So she was there, they met, and then the consequence of that was this enormous love affair. I don't think there's much more known about her than what I've said. There's more, a bit more detail, but not much.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned there so many mysteries remain, and in your book you have Fulbert as her dad, her father, and I'm interested to know what the role that fiction plays in looking into, in exploring these figures in terms of the unknowns about their life.
Well, it plays quite a big part, and you've got to be careful, because they met, Abelard and Eloise, they had conversations, nobody knows what they were. Their letters, you know from their letters what they said to each other in letters. You have that fantastic resource of their letters when they write to each other. But that's what they say in their letters. And I don't, or in Abelard's confession. Now, we're in double tricky waters here. Their letters are often hyperbolic, because that was the nature of the time. Their letters are often citing authorities, because that was the way you wrote at the time. You didn't say, I think this. You say, as St. Jerome said, and as Seneca said, and as Cicero said. And then you, three paragraphs now, and you bed down, you venture your own agreement with that. That was the style and the manner of it if you were a great scholar. And she wanted to prove she was a great scholar, so she was extremely attached to this way of discussion, and extraordinarily learned and easy in bringing up quotes from rare commentaries, Isidore, Gregory, and so on. She'd bring those up. And he was a scholar, so he did that all the time. So you have the letters, but what happened when they were alone? What happened when he seduced her, if he did seduce? Yes, he did seduce her. What happened then? What happened when they were on the run in Brittany? Which is where he came from. He was from a noble family in Brittany. What happened when he smuggled her back to Argenteuil on the boat as he took him down the river? What happened? Well, we don't know. But what I wanted to do was to imagine it, think hard about the characters and say, what would they have said? Where did that take them? What happened next was X. So on the way to X, they must have done whatever the letter is before X, W. They must have done these things to get there. So that is fiction. That is embodying it in a different way, imagining it in a different way. I wanted to do that. And he, to talk about him, he was the greatest scholar of his day. He's still thought of as a great scholar today. For philosophy, that's an amazing thing. Hundreds and hundreds of years on, Abelard still matters. He was turning over centuries and centuries of church learning on his own, attacking it. Very exposed position. The church was power. It's probably one of the most powerful organizations over many peoples, over many cultures, over many years that there has ever been. They were ferocious in wanting, and then we're at the time when they're tightening the screws of conformity, and then wanting young men to join of great ability, which is why they were backing these things. But Abelard was teaching these young men to be pagans, as they thought. He was loving. Aristotle was thought of as a pagan writer, and therefore to be dismissed. What's this pagan doing talking about our sacred texts and so on? But Abelard was a brilliant man. And they had, in those days, the system of public jousting with words and sort of a hangover, as it were, no, an association, affinity with his jousting as he would have been had he been, he handed over his inheritance to his brother, had he been a knight and got the crusades, which his brother did and so on. So he'd won all those battles in public. And he published books, which people thought were stunning. And he'd become the head of the master of the College of Notre Dame. It's all very confusing because the Cathedral of Notre Dame was not built then. So I have to explain very quickly. He'd done all that. And he was extraordinary. And we're told that he wrote popular songs, which were sung in the streets and so on. There was no stopping him. And then he writes this piece. He writes this piece 13 years after they parted, about his life, one of the greatest pieces in medieval literature, autobiographical pieces. So they didn't go in for autobiography. You have St. Augustine, then you have bits and this, then you have Abelard's piece. My theory is that he wrote it 13 years later to prove that he'd been terrible, to prove that he'd been a sinner, to prove that everything he'd done was awful, to prove that he was thoroughly, because the way they believed in excess and what he was saying to God, that was a letter to, it was supposed to be to a friend. We don't know who it was to. Nobody knows who it was to. Nobody knows how Eloise got her hands on it. But he was actually, that was a letter to God saying, I am the most miserable, miserable sinner, and please forgive me. I did these terrible things. I was boastful. I was vain. I took advantage. And I think that's what the tone of it is. And a lot of people take it at its face value and think, what a terrible man he was. He's saying he's a terrible man, but it's an unreliable text. He wants God to know that he knows how terrible it is. When Catholics went into confession, Catholics of his, because he was a Catholic, of his intensity, they would say, I've done the most terrible thing. Now, by the standards of many people, it wasn't all that terrible, not what he did with Eloise, with other things they do, and all that terrible, but they say it's terrible because they want God to forgive them. So that was the basis on which I took that. And then you had all sorts of strange things. They parted for 13 years, or did they? What happened then? You had to make that up, and so on. So there's the making up thing. I know that a lot of people don't understand the 12th century. I didn't myself. I read history at university, but I didn't spend much time on that, and I read a lot about it. It's a world with a circumference. Everything comes from God. And if you didn't believe in God in the Christian community, you kept your mouth shut or your tongue cut out, you kept very quiet about it. Abelard believed that everything emanated from and related back to God. There's no problem about it. So when Eloise said, they were so comfortable with it that Eloise thought she could call God cruel. She would, as it were, never speak to him again. But she was perfectly sure that there would be a corner for her in heaven. So it was that relationship, which is... She was, as it were, in the party. She could criticize the party as much as she wanted because she was so deeply in the party. She was deeply part of it. So was he. So he's bound with that. And she is bound. Talk about people not understanding what's going on. So how do I make that? Do I do long explanatory notes? And then I just had this idea of having a companion story. And the second story, we investigate the first. So in one stage, I thought of calling it The Quest for Eloise and Abelard. These two, the writer of the book And one of his, and his daughter, who's 23, 24, who comes across to Paris because she's out of a job, and he invites her. He's finishing the book in Paris in his brother's flat. His brother's a reporter, has gone away, so it's in Paris. It's a nice place to do it, and he's a single man by that time. He and his wife are split up. His daughter comes over. She has got a purpose, and her purpose is to find out what really happened in her father and mother's marriage, which they have never told her, really, and she's very upset. So she's there to, and he says, well, while you're here, why don't you read what I'm writing? In order that he can have something to say to her, so it's a father-daughter loving relationship. What am I going to do, sit and have a drink with, he doesn't drink much every day, or give her something to do, as it were. And also to explain through her to readers what is going on and the value of what's going on. And they're two different reasons. She thinks that Abelard's a total shit from the beginning. And he's saying, just hold on. I'm trying to understand him, not judge him. So what if you think that way? What if you, this is what was happening then. I try not to be pedantic about it, but I don't think I am. And just, well, when he did that, this was the society he was in. Do you realise the odds he was against? Do you realise this man's books were burnt twice in public? His books were burnt. He was banned from here, there, and everywhere, hunted down. He was almost stoned to death. We're talking big, serious matters. You've got to understand that. That formed his character. And also, he knew he was good. He knew he was better than all the others. He kept beating them in. So I wanted to explain him. And I wanted to explain some way of explaining her intense spirituality, even though she thought God was cruel, and she had no vocation, she didn't want to become a nun, but she was an intentionally spiritual woman. And when he first said he loved her, she asked what it meant, and they talk about it early on in the book, and she said she knows what it means. It means that I will obey you, because she'd been brought up to obedience. I will obey you. I will never desert you. I will never. I'll do everything you want me to do. And then that begins in the early stages, applies erotically. And then in the later stages, applies in the things she does that he tells her to do, asks her to do, tells her to do, which she knows are going to be bad for their relationship. Because he was terrible at making decisions. Almost every decision he made was wrong. He didn't know, I mean, he's one of those people, and I knew people like that. And I've done, I was so consumed by his own mind. You find it with some physicists and that. When they say the absent-minded physicists, it's not just a cliche. They're thinking so hard and they forget things. And he solved things. Abelard's great thing was that he solved problems. He tried to solve every problem in the Bible, which is fantastic. And he did. So he would solve problems like that, and you think it was solved. Oh, I will take you into dress as a nun, and I'll take you to see my parents in Brittany. Well, that was a form of abduction. Never occurred to him that he was abducting her, and that her family could, being that time it was, could have exercised a sort of a blood feud on him, which they thought of doing, except his Breton relatives would have had a blood feud against Eloise. So he just didn't think. Then when he took her to Argenteuil after they were married, he didn't think what the consequences of that would be. He always saw everything very quickly because that's what he did in his life. And that was, and she kept telling him, this won't work. And like he decided they should get married. And she says wonderful speeches about how marriages are not for her, how it'll destroy their relationship, how she doesn't want to be his wife. She wants to be his friend. And if the Emperor Augustus himself offered to be, asked her to be his wife, she'd rather be Peter Abelard's whore than the emperor's wife. She says these things in the letters. And she's because she's allied herself with him. He is the man. I don't know whether she loves the philosopher or the man. They're both together. She loved philosophy. So you have this very intense, and I think that's why the Middle Ages and centuries afterwards took to it. It was so spiritual, intense, and so lasting. People elided the fact they'd been apart for 13 years apart. And another thing is that it's the belief system. I mean, when he said you must go back to Argenteuil take up a vocation, she said, I don't believe in it. He said, but you must do it because then you'll become a bride of Christ. Now, to Abelard, in a sense, in his simplicity, that solved everything. Because a bride of Christ meant that you were near Christ, you were nearer Christ than anybody else, than any monk, than any archbishop. You're a bride of Christ. And so that would make her safe. Her soul would be safe. She could pray for his soul, which she thought was damaged and almost irretrievable, if she prayed for his soul. And you had these great prayer sites all over Europe. I mean, a third of the population was engaged in prayer, and they believed it. They just chanting the prayers, like you people go down Oxford Street doing Hare Krishna all the time, prayer after prayer after prayer. And the more prayers, you would get through purgatory quickly. And so he thought he was not doing her a favor, but making her safe. I think there's also a little bit of sexual protection involved there, which I added, completely fictional on my part, because he was besotted with her. And then they parted, and that's complicated because he goes away, then he comes back, and then he's publicly arraigned and nearly stoned, and his work is burnt. And what is it? He invents the word theology. He turns to theology, goes back and writes it again twice as long. And he sets up as a hermit in the forest because he wants wants to get. What happens? Scores of wealthy young men from all over Europe come to him again, build their own little huts, and because he can teach them there. He is that amazing. At the time, I thought to be that amazing. He's also, although the Paris and the French hierarchy of clergy hated him, he was their star turn. They were getting rich through him, and also they were moving towards having university, and then people would come because of Abelard. Up on the left bank, they were thinking of having a university there. So he's there, and then in the letters, they divide into love letters, which are powerful, and arguments, and rage, and reason, and then what she calls letters of direction, where he's sending her letters about sermons. I think those are the love letters. I think that is exactly what she wanted from the very beginning. She said, I don't want to be your lover. Well, she didn't say that. I don't want to be your wife. I want to be your amica. In fact, I thought of calling it amica for a long time, your friend. In the end, that's what it is. And she's relentless with him. He's writing books, the biggest philosophy books at the time. And then she says, I want 93 sermons. Writes back, he says he's better than this. I'm no good at writing sermons, but here's the best I can do. So he takes her, then she reads back and says, a lot of the saints don't have their own hymns. Could you write hymns for all the saints who don't have hymns? Or we don't have a history of the place of nuns in the country. He writes this massive history, the bigger for her, it's taken God knows how long. And so she's relentless with him. And that's what she wants. She wants that friendship, that conversation through writing, through scholarship, which he himself said at the beginning is what he wanted, but he went another way as well.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does, or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest, whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/historyextra. Just go to Indeed.com/historyextra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
I wonder where you fall on the thought that this extensive collection of letters that from which we know about their relationship may have been, I'm not sure what word to use, but not staged or fabricated, but they were aware of creating their own chronicle through those letters.
Oh, I think they were very self-conscious people, yes, very. I mean, you heard, well, did they think these letters were going to be published? No. I don't think that was part of it. I think he would send out the letter about his life, history of my calamities, to a friend or friends, however. That's all mysterious about where he sent it to. We know Eloise got it. But no, I think the letters, they lived in that hyperbolic state. And also they were excessively in love. And that is also true. I mean, he had never been with a woman before. He was 35. She'd, of course, never been with a man before. And the whole thing excited them, opened their eyes, and they changed them utterly for a while. They didn't know what to do with it except to embrace it, which they did furiously. And then they couldn't handle how to organize it. And he made mistake after mistake just in organizing what they did, whether they should get married, things like that. He got it wrong all the time.
Could we talk a little about how the terrible punishment that was carried out against him affected him and his work and his attitude towards it?
Well, when he had taken her to Brittany and they had a child, her father, egged on by his advisors, her father was an important canon in Notre Dame, the church of Saint-Étienne, but he was not in a... And his friends urged him to take a blood thing, but he wouldn't do that. He daren't do that, or he decided not to. Anyway, what he did do was arrange for a castration, a famous castration. Abelard was castrated. And being the knightly man, he said it didn't hurt because these things didn't matter if you were A, a believer, and B, a knight. Didn't hurt. The things that hurt you most, you say, didn't hurt. Anyway, he was castrated. There was a furore in Paris. The people who did it were castrated and blinded, except Fulbert, who had organized it, got away with it. He barricaded himself in the cloisters. They gathered round him, the canons, took his livelihood away, his furniture, then gave it him back a year later. But it affected him. Well, he was worried about whether he would be... Because people... Well, what happened to a eunuch? Immediately came to his mind all the stuff about eunuchs in Leviticus and so on. We said, even if animals have their testicles crushed, they must not be allowed into the temple, and so on and so forth. And he was there any place for eunuchs in heaven? And at first he couldn't find any, and then he looked up and found things that were said. But that was the first thing. Second thing, he thought that his force as a public speaker might be gone. Seems it did a bit at first, but not so. But he was ashamed of it. And people wrote damning indictments of it. My print one, which was by Rosalind, his former teacher, saying what a terrible man he was, going and taking advantage of this young woman living in her uncle's house, and instead of teaching her the classics, taught her how to fornicate and so on. This was public stuff. So there's a lot of shame he had to endure. So that changed him, and I think that drove him away from her in the sense that I'm going to contaminate her. I've got to get her away. I must put her somewhere where she's safe from me, from my reputation now. And I think I don't emphasize that too much in the book, but it's obvious. So, yes, it changed him. I think it did change him. Except in one thing, what never changed was his dedication to philosophy. Under all the extremes, he's still doing the work. I mean, masses of work. He wrote a book about conversation between an Arab, a Jew, and a Christian. He wrote book after book. So that was what he was about. I mean, he, except for that fairly brief eruption in his body and his mind about enemies, where he actually has to work out what love is. He doesn't know what love is, and he tries to work it out. And there's two stages where I'm in, he's lying in bed trying to work out what it is, because he can't articulate it. Well, that is not the way he is. He's got to be able to articulate it. So he works through what it is, caring for other people. It's, what is it? And I was reading them again last night, actually. I thought, that's not a bad expression of what it is. So, but that's fiction. And then he knows what it is. But after that, there's nothing more to do with feelings. He's away from her. He thinks she's safe. But the moment she writes to her, he writes back immediately. The moment she's in trouble, whether she is kicked out of her nunnery, she's by then head of the nunnery, even though she's hypocritical about it. She practices hypocrisy. She's quite plain about that. She's better than all the other nuns, but she's pretending. But she's head of the convent. And a few years then breeds other convents all over. She's thrown out. They wander around this group of nuns with her. Some of them peel off to other places. There's a choir stays with her, and they don't know what to do. His place in the forest that has been built, he just gives it to her like that. As soon as he hears, he comes from where he's then in, made another mistake by going to Britain into this god-awful place as an abbot. He isn't an abbot. He doesn't know how to be an abbot, of course. He just went there to get out of the way. And he comes across, she's not there. He gives her this place. He builds it up. He writes to the Pope. The Pope replies. The Pope makes it legitimate. He gets in touch with the local landowner. I mean, when he wants to move, because God, I've had a letter from Abelard. He wants me to do this little thing, like saying he's giving the paraclete. Of course he must. So he gets a letter back. And so he gives that all to her. And then when she writes him her first letter, saying, basically, why did you not address your confession to me? He replies immediately, and away it goes. And everything she asks him for, he gives her right away.
It's a remarkable story and a remarkable relationship, obviously, as many listeners will know. But is there an aspect of it particularly that drew you? Was it Abelard? Was it what was it that drew you particularly to this 12th century story?
I don't quite know. I came across the story like the writer in the book when I was 15. It was mentioned in a book called The Cloister and the Heart, the book by Charles Reade, which we did for O-level. And I've no idea why a working-class boy in the north of England in the 1950s should be drawn to this. But I was. There was an image of. I haven't gone back to it, actually, in case I'm wrong. Okay, it spoils it. These two wandering around in the garden, and people are saying, that's Abelard and Eloise. She is this and he is that. And they're talking great philosophy. And I thought, wouldn't that be wonderful to walk around in the garden with somebody talking great philosophy? Maybe I thought that. Maybe I didn't think that. It doesn't matter what I thought. The image stayed. Then I came across the letters about 15 years later, and I read them, and I thought, then I kept them. And for many years, we're talking about 60 years, I was thinking, I don't know, maybe I should do something about this. And eventually I thought, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it now. You know, the sun's going through the thing. And so I did. And then I found this double way to do it, the double story. One story and another story investigating the first story. I was investigating it, but I didn't want to make that puddingy. I think the way I do it makes it unpuddingy.
That was Melvyn Bragg. Love Without End, A Story of Eloise and Abelard, is out now in the UK, published by Scepter. In the US, it's due to be released in the autumn by Arcade. Well, that's about it for today, but don't forget to check out our special offer for podcast listeners at subscribe.historyextra.com/podcast. We'll be back on Thursday with a discussion about the Tudor state and Tudor church. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. You can catch up with past episodes on historyextra.com, where you'll also find thousands of articles on all different aspects of history, as well as our special subscriber-only area, the library.